Welcome to Runt Packet, an occasional podcast of Packet Pushers where we talk to a particular people. Today, I want to introduce you to Arista Networks, and I've got Doug Goulet, who is the person responsible for product and solutions marketing for Arista Networks. Prior to joining Arista, Doug was VP of data center marketing at Cisco Systems before he left to join Arista with a number of other people who are well-known figures in the industry. Doug has filed or holds more than 20 patents in networking technology. Welcome, Doug.
Hey, welcome. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me, mate.
Okay, so probably the first thing to do is to introduce Arista very briefly to the audience and tell us a little bit about what Arista is doing.
Sure. Arista, really at the core of it, manufactures high-performance LAN switches for the data center. And if you home into it, you know, every time Ethernet's had a speed shift, there's been several new companies that have come on the market and several older ones that were either acquired or sort of faded into the sunset. Our goal is to capture the 10 gigabit transition that we're in the midst of as it moves from a switch connection to a server connection for high performance to the server connection by default, and to be ahead of that curve. And we really only want to focus on the data center. I think a mistake we've seen a lot of other companies do in the past was try to go too broad too quickly.
So I've seen a number of companies over the years look at different areas of the marketplace but try to be everything to everybody and become nothing to anybody.
Exactly. We don't want to do that.
And so this focus on the data center is driving your products to is based on a very different sort of an approach. So what I can see is that narrow focus on the data center means that Arista is very, very tightly focused on producing products that are got some technical differences. So why don't you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. If you look in the data center, from a hardware perspective, what matters is throughput / performance. In some markets, low latency, specifically high performance computing, high frequency trading on Wall Street, in capital markets areas. Those types of characteristics matter. Airflow matters, front to rear or rear to front. You need to choose the right airflow for the deployment you're putting the product in. Cable length matters. Media type matters. Power efficiency. We ran out of space. We ran out of cooling. We ran out of power. So a more efficient infrastructure matters in the data center. And all these things get measured because they're all centralized. And then if you look at the data center, we also look at, from a software perspective, what technology disruptions are happening. Well, there's a shift towards IP storage and storage going over a consolidated network. And virtualization is really disrupting the way we've designed and built data center networks, with demands for larger, flatter layer 2 networks, or at least IP address preservation through virtual machine move across a larger number of switch boundaries.
Yeah, so there's two things to take out of that. One is that low latency drives high performance for storage, for IP-based or even bridging-based storage, and also improves application response time. So you're focusing on latency as one feature.
And yes.
And then secondly, your software platform is radically different from other people's, if I remember rightly.
From the hardware, it's low latency and high performance / non-blocking and lossless, right? So set those kind of three pieces up as what the hardware needs to enable from a silicon perspective and from a data plane perspective. The sheet metal you wrap it in needs to be environmentally friendly and fit into the data center as effectively as possible. And also just, can I easily get it into my data center? So form factor and footprint matter.
Yep.
Right, because some of the data centers are some of the most expensive real estate in the world. So using less of that is a good thing for customers. Thirdly, as you alluded, the software. And we did want to take a very different view with software. I think every 10 years you see new software architectures from monolithic to multi-process. And now even looking at nowadays, multi-process, independent, no shared memory architecture for inter-process communications, no message, no distributed IPC or decoupled message buses. So a single central state machine and central database that all processes communicate to and through in a publish-subscribe model allows even more granularity of an independence of processes. So if you remember those 200-day bugs we've had in the past, in networking, where every 200 days the box locks up and reloads. Well, in software terms, it's usually a slow memory leak.
Yeah.
And that slow memory leak cascades until it's consuming too much. The process is restarted maybe by a watchdog or it fails. Mm-hmm. That process cascades to two or three others, which then in turn are corrupted and fail, and the box times out, errors, reboots, non-maskable interrupts generated, and the box comes back up.
And this, you're seeing this a lot today because, say, current switching platforms, a lot of the current switching platforms are running multiple software instantiations. Every blade's got a software instance, the backplane has a software instance, the switching fabrics has a software instance, and then the control plane's got a software instance.
And our goal was, you know, twofold. One, make each of those instances more reliable by having true process separation and independence, essentially taking what might be a SEV1 defect that would cause a network reboot and making it a SEV3, a process restarted, no packets or messages were lost. Right. And we've seen that in production. The second thing is normalizing that software across as many platforms as possible. When you buy an operating system from Apple, when I upgraded the Snow Leopard for my MacBook Pro, I bought the DVD, I put it in, I upgraded my OS, I took the exact same DVD and loaded the OS into my Mac Pro, my Mac Mini, and an iMac because I bought the Family Edition. That's one operating system, the exact same code base and binary now running across multiple boxes because it detects the hardware platform and loads the right device drivers. We're doing the same thing in switching. It's one operating system, but more importantly, it's one single system binary.
Okay, so the natural limitation of that, of course, is that you're then locked to a given, say, CPU or a given silicon architecture. You're suggesting in what you're saying there that the EOS software, which is the name of your operating system for your switches, is actually capable of diversifying into multiple platforms as needs be. Is that true?
Right now, it runs across the six 1RU form factors we're shipping, as well as our modular and a virtual machine instance.
So it can scale to different CPU platforms.
Yeah.
Because I've noticed that I was reading some documentation from Andy Bechtolsheim, who is one of the lead engineers there, who's very famous for his work at Sun, and he was making comments about the silicon architecture. And one of the marketing points that you've taken up before is that merchant silicon versus custom silicon. So obviously Cisco has moved into custom silicon, and every one of their blades has Cisco's proprietary silicon, or the, you know, the ASR 1000 has this quantum flow processor, whatever it is. Whereas Arista's doing something very different by saying we're going to take something close to merchant silicon, which is silicon chips that are made in en masse off the shelf, get them in there, and then use a software platform. And that's got some advantages. Do you want to talk us through that? I missed some of the logic behind it.
Sure. Well, first off, if you look at, let's take a platform like the Nexus 7000, the 32-port 10-gig module shipping for it. I remember working on the silicon product requirements in 2001 and 2002 for those.
Yeah.
Yet the system didn't start shipping until 2008, and the silicon's still shipping today. It's like building a data center off of Pentium 2s, okay, from a timing perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I've often complained about the Nexus being old technology. It looks it.
Well, and the problem is that if you build your own silicon, you have to sell enough of it to make it worth the investment. And building silicon is increasingly expensive. So the right business decision for Cisco clearly was ship the chips as long as they can in as many platforms as possible. But now the business units don't actually work together. So you're only shipping your chips in one business unit's products, or maybe two if you're lucky, so you don't get enough mass. So now you have to extend the length of time you're shipping these. Okay. Well, we want to take a different approach, which is let's partner closely with companies like Broadcom and Dune and Fulcrum Microelectronics and convey to them the same type of feature requirements we would have had if we were building our own silicon, so they can customize what they're building to meet our requirements. And what we get from this is the same level of interaction I would have had if I had my own ASIC team sitting down the hall from me, but now I've got three or four of them, and they're all competing for the business. They're going to be on slightly different skewed development cycles. One might have a product that comes out this year. One might be the next year. And that lets me have a freedom of choice and better supply chain. I can choose the best silicon that's available today to meet my customer requirements and then bring it to market. Well, given that it's a more current silicon architecture, you get more efficient ASIC process, better density. You're getting 20 millimeter per side on a die versus 17. You're getting more efficient process. And by going full custom versus the ASIC flow that single vendor silicon is, clock rates, we're at 1.2 to 1.5 gigahertz. Some of the chips running in a Nexus 5000 or 7000 might be 300 or 400 megahertz. Now we're seeing six times the clock rate, 40% more die size at 2 to 4x the transistor density. And then you wonder, why can I, with a single chip, have the same wire speed performance that you get with 30 to 40 pieces of silicon on other alternative architectures.
You know, you're running smaller silicon, you're running it faster because your development cycle is co-sourced. You're working tighter with your partners. Now, one of the correlations of this, which some people can miss, of course, is that your software then gets full-time development and full focus.
Exactly.
Right. So you're not spending, you don't have a team of half over here cutting silicon designs and fabbing and working out how to wrap metal around a box with a backplane and all that and cutting 15-year design plans. You've got a team inside your organization who are cutting software, and that's their focus.
I would say that 80% of our engineering, 80 to 90% of our engineering resources are in the software team. And the software team started the first 4 years of their life by building the software infrastructure necessary to be a scalable development organization. Building this software architecture, the system database that allows for a distributed programming model where we can rev versions of Spanning Tree or OSPF and RIBD or even the LED driver, for all I care, completely independent of anything else. So now we can assign engineers to different projects. They can work on their project, and the abstraction layer between the different engineering teams that are working on different processes is far more structured and automated through this development process. What it means is 40 to 50% of our software is machine-generated code that's compiled. Right. The other thing we get is less engineers delivering higher quality code more rapidly at a lower cost. So customers see more features faster with higher quality. We're then capable of opening that up to customers because we trust it, so we can allow customers to add their own features and capabilities because we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest problems I've had in networking is I have to buy the chipset, the hardware, the operating system, and the features all from a single vendor. I mean, let's be frank, that's worse than the mainframe environment ever was as far as closed systems. This is not a platform. Yeah. This is the ultimate in vendor lock-in.
There's a whole bunch of things around that, but I like the idea of the software focus because it means the things that really matter to the customers, while the silicon's good and exciting, and you know, having the low latency and the high-speed backplane and then you know all that lossless stuff, it's the software that we use every day. It's the operational functionality that really matters. And the idea that you've actually got a team of people who, you know, the bulk of your company is developing software means we're getting features. So things like software features like routing protocols, the upcoming DCB stuff will be implemented presumably very quickly because it's not very difficult for you to implement. Is that true?
That's true. In fact, we already offer priority flow control as well as the data center bridging extensions. That's already available today. The hardware is capable of the majority of these things, so we simply are writing in software. And you hit on something that to me is absolutely critical. I'm a bit of a history buff, okay? So, you know, a bit of an engineer, a bit of a history buff, and sadly I'm wearing a marketing title. But if you think about this, let's look back and say when the heyday of growth in networking, the mid to late 90s, right, or the early 90s, 1993 onward to about 2001 before the dot-com bust, the type of features that the market leaders built for their customers in that time frame were not big, expensive TV sets, right? The type of features and capabilities they built were features like EIGRP, VTP, Ether Channel, things that goal was to make the network operator's job easier at scale so that when I deployed my first 10 boxes, it worked well, but when I'm making the decision to buy the next two or four, I had a real legitimate reason to go with that same vendor and extend that footprint. So our goal is how do I build those type of operational features that make network engineers' jobs easier?
I look back at Cisco's ISL protocol, which came out like in the very late 90s, and it was amazing at its time. It just revolutionized the way we did our network designs. But I don't believe it took Cisco a whole lot of effort to make that happen. But today, they're not delivering any of those types of functions in their systems.
Right. So let's look at, you know, I can argue that almost every feature and capability brought out in networking in the last decade actually made the network engineer's job harder, not easier.
Well, I wouldn't argue with you. I'm not looking forward to implementing Trill, you know, or any of these. Some of these data center bridging stuff is going to be fairly hairy. I mean, we're going to create these massive layer two domains with only a limited set of controls.
So let's look at the type of features we can be building that will make people's jobs simpler and easier. I mean, we've spent hundreds of man years building quality of service, but how come quality of service can't be managed consistently across thousands of ports in my network when I almost always want a consistent QoS implementation?
Yeah, I want to have the same QoS configuration on every port, on every switch.
Yes.
Right? That's the way we think. We say, I want this traffic to be profiled, and then the exception is on these ports, it's going to be different. That's really how we configure it. Yeah.
So why don't we name ports into profiles, create an object-oriented configuration model, and use OSPF opaque LSAs for the distribution of the configuration tied to a particular profile?
Okay, I can see that. For those of you who don't know what an opaque LSA is, hit the books. You'll work it out pretty quickly. You'll need special books. Okay.
Throw one other one at you just real quick. Sure. This is one of my personal favorites. Does your switch reboot right? When you type the command reload, it turns the ports off and generates a non-maskable interrupt. Is that right? Shouldn't we say goodbye first?
Shouldn't we shut down, gracefully signal out to neighboring switches?
Set route metrics to infinity, send VRRP leave, send LACP marker PDUs, freeze spanning tree, stop propagating BPDUs, hold down long enough for IGPs to converge around this pending administrative outage. 95% of outages are predicated with the command reload. Let's make it work right.
And these are things that you – so what you're trying to say to me there is that you, these are things that you can deliver because you're focused on the operating system, and that abstraction away from the hardware to some extent is going to give you the ability to innovate very quickly and come up with new capabilities, new features.
It's about re-injecting innovation in networking, but innovation focused on the network operator, not moving into so-called market adjacencies.
Yeah, inventing, you know, flip video cameras, for example.
Yeah. I have one. I like it. It's a great product. I don't get the network
time. I think we've taken up enough of our listeners' time. Why don't we close it off? Why don't you hit me with some key points about Arista that would give people some more information about the product and make them want to come and talk to you about it?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, if I was to say one thing, it's that we're following a recipe that works. Focus on a market, data center switching. It's all about the software. Right? It's about building the software capabilities. In this case, ones that focus on the network operator. If you run a network, this is a good system to check out.
Yeah.
If you're a network guy, if you're a Unix guy, you can use the command bash. Right? You can then you can type you can tail-f the log file and watch it if you want, or you can go download fping or mrtg or cobbler and run them on the switch. It's extensible. Load your own applications.
Wow.
Be part of it. We want to drive innovation. And we're going to do that by capturing some technology transitions that we all see happening. The move to IP storage, right? The move towards unified fabrics and, you know, single network fabrics, and also virtualization. You'll see capabilities coming from Arista over the next couple of weeks that I think more tightly tie the network switching infrastructure to the virtualization infrastructure than you've ever seen before.
Okay, people, so it's over to you. This podcast was intended to introduce you to Arista and some of their data center switching products in about, well, we're supposed to be 15 minutes, but it's come up a bit longer. I've been interested in watching new vendors coming on the market and to see what attack they're taking, and I wanted to share Arista to you. So if there's some technical details that you'd like some more information on, or if you want me to deep dive into this more with Doug in the future, and we'll get some engineers on and we can go as nerdy as you want me to be, then get in contact. Maybe you want to argue the difference between a Cisco product or an Arista product with me. Email me your questions to greg@etherealmind.com or get onto the blog site at packetpushers.net and leave a comment, and then I'll set up another show if there's enough interest. Leave your feedback about the show on the website at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. You can follow me, Greg Farrow, on Twitter at etherealmind, and find me at etherealmind.com. Doug, where can people find you?
At aristanetworks.com. www.aristanetworks.com. I also have a blog on Network World and a personal one at douglasgourlay.com.
Fantastic. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.